Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks. In 30 minutes, we'll be joining my colleague James Kumarasamy in Berlin for his reflections with a panel of guests on the German elections on Sunday. Big changes wrought there. But we're beginning in Washington because among French and British political classes, certainly for several days now, there's been one overriding question. How should the country's respective leaders, when they arrive this week at the White House, try to persuade Donald Trump to take more heed of Europe and Ukraine when it comes to ending Russia's war inside Ukraine? The British Prime Minister Keir Starmer is going to have his go on Thursday. Today, on the third anniversary, the day tens of thousands of Russian troops poured over the border into Ukraine, it was the French president, Emmanuel Macron, who turned up at the White House. And the two men spoke a couple of times to the press. First, a little more informally before they retired for lunch, the two men sat knee to knee in the Oval Office to answer questions shouted at them by the assembled throng of reporters. First, we know that President Trump is keen to see this war end as quickly as possible. How quickly does he think a deal can be done?
Within weeks.
Weeks?
Yeah.
At what price for Ukraine?
Don't you think so? I'd like to ask have you. I think we could end it within weeks if we're smart. If we're not smart, it'll keep going and we'll keep losing young, beautiful people that shouldn't be dying. And we don't want that. And remember what I said. This could escalate into a third world war. And we don't want that either.
For much of the encounter with the reporters, it was Donald Trump holding forth with Emmanuel Macron's face in a studiously neutral mode. But there was one moment where the French president couldn't resist interrupting the flow, and that was over the contentious issue of just how much the US has contributed to the Ukrainian war effort, especially compared to Europe.
Europe is loaning the money to Ukraine. They get their money back.
No, in fact, to be frank, we paid. We paid 60% of the total effort. And it was through, like the US, loans, guarantee, grants, and we provided real money, to be clear.
And what are the President Trump's view of the Russian president in contrast to his dusty view of the Ukrainian president?
If the president called Zelensky a dictator, would you use the same words regarding Putin?
I don't use those words lightly. I think that we're going to see how it all works out.
So Vladimir Putin is not someone, it seems, Mr. Trump would readily call a dictator. What about the chances that were a peace deal somehow to be concluded, that it could be policed by troops from European Union, in other words, NATO member states?
Will you convince Vladimir Putin to accept the European troops as peacekeeper, do you think?
Yeah, he will accept that.
He will accept
that? I've asked him that question.
You talked to him?
I've asked him that question.
He said yes?
Look, if we do this deal, he's not looking for more war. He doesn't mind, but I've specifically asked him that question. He has no problem with it.
Well, the two men then retired for a quick bite to eat and afterwards had a rather more formal press conference with lecterns standing side by side. President Macron at that point did pledge that there would be more support for Ukraine from Europe, but he also said that American support was essential to avoid what he called a fragile peace in Ukraine.
We are ready to be engaged. As for France, a lot of my European colleagues are ready to be engaged. But we do need this American backup because this is part of the credibility of the security guarantees. And this is our collective deterrence capacity.
Emmanuel Macron speaking within the last hour. Well, the BBC's Nomi Iqbal has been following the press conferences at the White House and joins us from the White House now. Nomi, we played a few clips of things that struck us from the two men's engagement. Tell me what struck you.
Well, I was inside the East Room as that conference was taking place, and it was all very chummy, pally. You know, their body language was very positive towards each other. It was the same in the Oval Office. I mean, the media here call it a bromance. And so they had very nice things to say about each other. But I think what really struck me was in the lengthy answers that Emmanuel Macron gave, he constantly came back to wanting security assurances for Ukraine. Something that Donald Trump didn't mention once in the conference. Do note that Emmanuel Macron is the first European leader that has come to the White House since Donald Trump was re-elected. He's here because he wants to make sure Ukraine and Europe are at the center of any talks about ending the war and to make sure, as I say, that there are security insurances for Ukraine. Now, if Donald Trump has softened his position on Ukraine, if he has hardened his position on Vladimir Putin, he didn't show it or say it in that press conference.
Right. And in terms of possibly seeing Vladimir Zelensky, I mean, there's been a lot of talk about when he might see Vladimir Putin. But in terms of seeing Vladimir Zelensky and talk about this this controversial deal that the US is keen to strike, it seems, with Ukraine over extraction of its rare earth mineral deposits worth possibly hundreds of billions of dollars. Was there any further comment from Mr. Trump on any of that?
Well, President Trump seems convinced that a deal is close. There's a lot of confusion over whether it's happening, whether it's not. Mr. Zelensky has made it clear that, he has to get something in return for it. Those security assurances, that's what they want. And Ukraine says that's not been the case, which is why Mr. Macron, I imagine, kept bringing it up in the conference. Mr. Trump did say that he will meet President Zelensky at some point this week, next week. We never get an exact timeline when Mr. Trump talks about meeting leaders. Same with President Putin. He has said that he will meet Mr. Putin. There's some talk it could be in May. He said that he might go to Moscow, which would be extraordinary if that happens, but he says it won't be anytime soon. There might be a summit in Saudi Arabia. So it's all just very much, for want of a better word, very fluid.
Norma Rickwell, thanks for bringing us the latest in the White House. Well, it hasn't just been about Emmanuel Macron and Donald Trump today. Lots of leaders been speaking about Ukraine on this third anniversary of the full-scale Russian invasion. Among them, of course, Volodymyr Zelensky, who was in Kiev with European and Canadian leaders showing their solidarity. On the specific point about when the war might end and what Nomia was talking about, what guarantees Ukraine would need, this is what President Zelensky had to say today.
We hope that we can finish this war this year, not in 3 years. If we speak about how to prepare security, Russia, they can come back in 10 years if we will not be prepared. They will not come back if we will put them to their place, to their territory, and if Ukraine will be in EU and in NATO in closest years, of course it will help us very much.
One note of discord today is that over at the United Nations General Assembly, the US voted against a resolution condemning Russia for invading Ukraine. A suggestion of a stark divide between the US and its European allies. It was something that I put to Mike Gonzalez, senior fellow at the conservative US think tank, the Heritage Foundation, where he focuses on foreign policy.
Not really. Trump is negotiating. He does not want to sabotage his own negotiation. I think your correspondent had it exactly right when he called what happened at the pool spray, at the Oval Office pool spray, and now at the press conference, a bromance. I myself described it earlier as a love-in. But, I mean, I just spent the last week in the U.K. and the week prior to that in Spain. And all I read in the Telegraph and the Guardian and in the press was that there was this crisis in transatlantic relationship. Well, there doesn't appear to be any. The Venn diagram overlap between Macron and Trump is complete.
Well, at least in public. Zoom. At least in public. But I mean, but the U.S. joining with Russia and North Korea and Nicaragua to vote down this resolution, which was all it was saying was that it condemned the Russian invasion of Ukraine and demanding that Ukraine be able to, at some point, regain its territorial integrity. I mean, it is. You've got to admit that it is a stark turn in events, don't you?
No, actually, no. I think the White House, and especially the president, are completely focused on this negotiation. I think that Pete Hegseth has already said that the Ukraine is not going to go back to pre-2014 borders. I think he was referring to Crimea, not to Donbass. So I think what they want to do is, and by the way, Trump sounded very, he said everything is on the table at the negotiation. And he said, hopefully we can get land back. So, you know, this is...
It's been an odd approach, though, from the master negotiator to these negotiations. That, I mean, he may be trying to walk things back now, but essentially he and his top people have said, you know, pretty much all the Russian talking points about Ukraine's never going to join NATO, it's not going to get all its land back, that he's going to insist on elections in Ukraine before any peace deal is concerned, calling Volodymyr Zelensky a dictator and refusing to call Vladimir Putin a dictator today. I mean, it's sort of been one talking point after another, he's conceded.
Biden's national security advisor, Sullivan, said in private that, of course, Ukraine was not going to join NATO. Mm. Ukraine has a lot of problems, including the fact that it has a foreign army occupying a big part of it. And if Ukraine were to join NATO and Article 5 kicked in, that would involve a world war
But essentially to say that they're never going to do so is, as I say, I mean, it just seems strange negotiating tactics from the man who has been described by his defense secretary as the master negotiator.
Their negotiations haven't even begun yet. We don't know what they're going to look like. I think we should be celebrating the fact that we're now going to start negotiating an end to this war. This war should never have taken place. This war is now 3 years old. It's entering its fourth year. Tens of thousands of people. We don't know how many people have been killed. My God, shouldn't we be... shouldn't we agree with Emmanuel Macron that it's a good thing that we're finally negotiating an end to the war?
But, I mean, you don't accept what I was suggesting about the UN General Assembly resolution today. I mean, what do you make of Friedrich Merz, the Atlanticist conservative new chancellor of Germany, saying after Donald Trump's statements last week, it's clear that this administration is largely indifferent to the fate of Europe?
Well, I don't think that is the case. As I said, I was just, before going to the UK, I was in Madrid. I attended the summit meeting of the Patriots Group, which is the third largest parliamentary group of the EU, representing millions of voters. They were very happy with Donald Trump. And across the channel, the largest party polling right now is Reform. I've attended a talk when I was in the UK by Nigel Farage. He's very pro-Trump.
And that was Mike Gonzalez from the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. We'll be getting a couple of voices, well, hearing a report from Ukraine and speaking to somebody in Ukraine in just a couple of minutes. We'll also be having an appreciation here on NewsHour of one of the singers with the most distinctive voices in popular music in recent years.
The first time ever I saw your face.
The sound of Roberta Flack. She's died at the age of 88. We'll look back at her life in about 30 minutes. Our main headline this hour, after a meeting with President Macron at the White House, Donald Trump has reiterated that the cost and the burden of securing any peace in Ukraine must be borne by Europe. You're with the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour, live from London, with me, Tim Franks. As we've been hearing, it's exactly 3 years since the start of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. President Trump has said he's working on a quick peace with Moscow, and one which, as currently sketched, could require significant concessions on Kyiv's part in exchange for a ceasefire. So what do Ukrainians think about the prospects? Our Ukraine correspondent, James Waterhouse, has been trying to find out.
Ukraine's war effort is becoming more divisive at home and abroad. Next to Kyiv's 120-year-old funicular, this cable car on the snowy hillside, a woman complained about drafting officers bundling a man into a car. This woman has a different view.
Everyone should fight, except the sick. Because if everyone had done that from the start and not hidden, we would have had peace for a long time already.
For Ukraine, it's an impossible balance. You have the not wanting tens of thousands of deaths to be for nothing versus not wanting the losses to continue.
Now US President Donald Trump has turned Western support on its head. His labelling of President Zelensky as a dictator, blaming Ukraine for the war, suggesting Russia has all the cards, they all represent a realignment, firmly with Moscow. And Oksana is baffled.
Some people don't understand us, so they listen to Russia position, but many people understand us. I know many, I have many friends from Europe that support Ukrainians.
Pushing his pram is Misha. Now, he's exempt from military service because of his IT job, but still feels disappointed in Donald Trump.
I'm not aware, I'm a civilian, but the people who are protecting my life, the life of my kid, and it's unfair to them in the first place. We feel bitter, but we also need to persevere, even if world doesn't support us as it did, I don't know, a month ago.
There is no doubting the yearning for peace in Ukraine, but if Donald Trump does not provide security guarantees to prevent Russia from invading again, then according to soldiers like Dimko, a ceasefire would not mean peace.
I'm a drone pilot in the Unmanned Systems Forces. I fly drones for Ukrainian Army.
What impact has all of the politics had on you personally as well as your comrades?
To me personally, it doesn't change a thing. I am still willing to defend my home. I know that if the United States will pull out all of the aid that they give to us, it's going to be just more deadly. But we are still going to stand our ground, still defend our home, still defend our family.
Major cities like Kyiv have kept functioning under the weight of Moscow's invasion, but its air defences have been kept very busy. We're in Boryspil, a Kyiv suburb. I was last here when I first landed in Ukraine. Here is a crater caused by a Russian drone. They are launched every night, designed to put pressure on the population. The blast shattered Zoya's window. She's taking us up to her apartment where her sick elderly mother stays, and her anxiety is palpable. But when I ask her about Donald Trump's vision of a quick peace, she says,
"Our country is our country, and it must remain ours. Giving up territories is wrong and unnecessary. There has to be an agreement."
Where there is agreement, as Europe and Ukraine work out how to stand up against Russia, is that they still need the support of America.
And that was James Waterhouse reporting from Kyiv. Natalia Zlatopolska lives in the city of Poltava, about 5 hours' drive east of the capital. She helps run a charity focused on mental health as well as teaching psychology at the local university. How does she feel on this, the third anniversary of the all-out conflict?
It seems to me it wasn't 3 years. It seems to me like I feel it was more than 10 years because we all tied and we all have problem with the mental health. It's a real statistic that more than half of our population have a problem with the mental health. First, what I did today, I remember all my friends who died, and my friends, they did the same.
And everybody in Ukraine, I imagine, everybody knows some people, probably many people, who have died over the last 3 years.
Yeah. As you know, in Poltava, it was a period of a very aggressive rocket attack, and many people died, among them my students, my friends.
When you say it affects everybody's mental health, can you talk to me a little bit about your state of mind and maybe what 3 years of war has done to you?
I recognize that I have some problem with my physical health, with my body, because of everyday stress. And I see that even For me, I can admit that high level of aggression connected with such events every day. For example, every day, 5 or 10 times, I heard a special alarm connected with rocket attack. And I have to find shelter with my children or with my students and continue my work in shelters.
Natalia, you've talked about all the stress and the strain of daily life, you know, rushing to the shelter. Mm-hmm. Given all the talk that there has been at the moment, particularly from the United States, about trying to get a quick end to this war, can you tell me, is that something that adds to the stress because you don't know what sort of peace you may be asked to accept? Or are you thinking to yourself, after 3 years of this, I just need the conflict to be over, even if we have to pay a heavy price?
From one side, people, they are waiting for peace. But I understand, I'm sure, that if we decided to write some agreement just now with Russia and the USA connected with our, for example, land resources, I think that in 5 or 10 years, Russia will continue such aggression. I think we have to find till the end.
May I ask you a very personal question, which is, I think I'm right in saying that you have two children, and one of them is a son, and he is 16 years old.
Yeah.
If you're talking about we need to fight to the end, I mean, in 2 years, he could be... Mm-hmm. asked to join the army. How would you and he feel about that, do you think?
As a mother, it's a very difficult choice for me. But in 2 years, according to our judicial system, my son became an adult and he'll decide what to do. But like mother, it's very difficult for me to understand this situation because I saw the portrait of my students who died during 3 years. It's a difficult question for me, but I see that we have no way.
You have no way but to continue to fight?
We continue to fight because it's a long story of our nation during more than 300 years. And every time Russia tried to do everything to stop our independence and to stop our development like a nation. Just now, it's a moment when we have to stop this history and to start to write a new history of Ukraine.
And that was Natalia Zlatopolska speaking to me from Poltava in east central Ukraine. This is NewsHour. Welcome back to NewsHour. Apple has published plans to invest $500 billion in the United States over the next 4 years. 20,000 new jobs will be created to boost research, development and manufacturing, including in chip engineering and artificial intelligence. Trip Mickle covers Apple out of San Francisco for the New York Times. How significant does he think this announcement is?
The big detail that's a new revelation here is that Apple is going to build or support the construction of a manufacturing plant in Houston to assemble servers. That's not something that it's done historically in the United States. And it's also part of its effort to try to supplement and support artificial intelligence on iPhones and other devices around the world.
And I guess it's maybe difficult to disentangle sort of motive and effect, but do you get a sense that the reason for this announcement and this level of investment is in order to try and show President Trump and those around him in the White House that, look, we, Apple, are doing our bit to invest in the United States? Or do you think it's, in a sense, in order to counter what it expects will be the blowback from the imposition of tariffs?
Probably a bit of both, to be totally honest. I mean, this has become part of Apple's playbook since Donald Trump arrived on the political scene in the run-up to the 2016 election. During that time, Donald Trump said that one of his goals was to get Apple to, quote, start building their damn computers and things in this country instead of other countries. And since then, Apple's been under the gun to fulfilled those demands from Trump. And it made an announcement in 2018 to invest $350 billion in the U.S. It made an announcement in 2021 during the Biden administration to invest $430 billion. And now it's making a promise to invest $500 billion. So you can see the steady cadence and ratcheting up of the investments, which honestly are probably just in line with Apple's business growth over that time period. Mm.
I think it was in the New York Times that suggested that the iPhone is perhaps the world's most globalized product. So I just wonder how far you think Apple is particularly exposed to the possibilities of there being some sort of global trade war.
Well, within the analyst community that follows Apple closely, this announcement and the meeting between Tim Cook and Donald Trump on Friday has raised possibility and the hope that Apple may actually avert tariffs for a second go-round. If we run back the clock to the first Trump administration, the Trump administration did not put levies on smartphones. It also remove tariffs that it put on the Apple Watch at Apple's request. And you may recall that during that time period, Tim Cook did a lot of work to cultivate a strong relationship with Donald Trump. Again, we're seeing shades of that here. And I talked to an analyst named Gene Munster, who believes that Apple has chosen to invest in the U.S. rather than pay Uncle Sam, and that this is an indication of that.
And that was Trip Mickle, the New York Times tech reporter covering Apple out of San Francisco. This is NewsHour.
You're listening to NewsHour with Tim Franks in London and me, James Kamara-Sami, in Berlin. And I'm sitting looking out over the Brandenburg Gate, that famous monument here in the centre of Berlin. Tonight it is bathed in the yellow and blue colours of the Ukrainian flag. That's because it is marking the third anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. There's been a pretty loud demonstration, an event in support of Ukraine, which is handily wrapped up just in time for our broadcast. But 3 years ago, after that full-scale invasion of Ukraine, the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz told MPs in the German Parliament, which is just a stone's throw from here, that it was a turning point for Germany's foreign and security policy. Today, it feels as though Europe's largest economy is at another turning point after Mr. Scholz was rejected by voters in yesterday's election. His centre-left Social Democrats, or SPD, finished third, getting their lowest share of the vote in decades. They do, though, look set to stay on as a junior partner in a coalition government led by the conservative Christian Democrats. The man who's set to be the next chancellor, Friedrich Merz, has already started negotiations with the SPD, shunning, as other parties do, the far-right AfD, which surpassed its previous record score, getting more than 10 million votes. That's around a fifth of all those cast. We'll discuss that in a few minutes' time. We're going to start with the next chancellor and what he's been saying about relations with the United States. Last night, on the eve, remember, of President Macron's White House visit, Friedrich Merz said it was clear the Trump administration was largely indifferent to Europe's fate, and he called for more European independence from America. When he spoke about relations with America earlier today, Mr. Merz, a keen Atlanticist, used less stark turns of phrase, but he did make it clear that, in his opinion, Germany and Europe as a whole needed to prepare for a new set of realities.
All the signals we are getting from the USA indicate that interest in Europe is clearly decreasing, and US willingness to get involved in Europe. I still hope that we can convince Americans that it is in our mutual interest that we continue to have good transatlantic relations. But as is always the case, you also have to handle the worst-case scenario.
Well, we can speak now to Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg. He was a defense minister in the CDU-led government of Angela Merkel. He's now chair of the Spitzberg Partners Investment and Advisory Firm and is on the line from Dusseldorf. Welcome to NewsHour. How do you suspect the next chancellor will perform on the international stage? He has set out this vision of a new period in transatlantic relations. Where is he going to fit in? Where's Germany going to fit in?
Well, Germany, James, needs to fit a leadership vacuum in Europe to a certain extent. And I think Friedrich Merz has made a rather bold statement yesterday night, yes, a little softer today, but he is not shying away from even confronting the second Trump administration and trying to phrase not only German interests, but European interests, and at the same time making clear that Europe needs to ramp up its efforts to become a bit more independent without risking NATO as such. So it's a bit squaring the circle, but I see him actually on a pathway of being more critical on one hand, and on the other hand, a bit more self-confident than what we've seen over the last few years.
In lockstep with the French?
Hopefully so, because over the last 3 years, the relationship between France and between Paris and Berlin has deteriorated rapidly on so many different topics. So I think he will try to seek a very close relationship with Emmanuel Macron, but also to strengthen his way of thinking and not to give even more room to the far right in France. And that's also an effort he needs to do in Germany. So it's a monstrous agenda he's having right now, but he needs to step up right away, and he doesn't have much time.
And he doesn't have a huge amount of international experience, which is what some people are rather concerned about.
Well, I would actually oppose to that. He is definitely more international than his predecessor. He has spent many years in the private sector. His network into the U.S. is actually pretty vast. He was the head of the so-called Atlantic Bridge, which is the leading transatlantic private organization in Germany. So he's well networked. And
yeah, well, it's interesting. Is that private relationship, the private sector relationship, is that something that perhaps the Trump administration is going to look more favorably on, or many people within it are from the private sector, aren't they?
It could be. At least he understands the kind of mindset. And the one thing Trump probably recognizes is someone who speaks somehow similar language and who is not just kissing the ring, but trying to meet him at eyes level.
Interesting. Well, thanks very much, Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg, former defense minister in the CDU-led government of Angela Merkel. I've also been discussing the international implications of the change in the German chancellery with Jana Pullierin. She's a senior policy fellow at the European Council of Foreign Relations here in Berlin. So what does she make of Friedrich Merz's comments about the United States and its relations with Germany and Europe?
I think what he wants to convey is a sense of urgency in Berlin, and he has changed his tone quite significantly. During the election campaign, he was still talking about possible deals with the Trump administration. There was a CDU delegation attending the Republican convention early on. When they came back, they were convinced that there were mutual interests and that one could work together, and that all wasn't so bad. I think now it is sinking in kind of how huge the shift will be in the transatlantic relationship, and he wants to ring the alarm bells in Germany.
Even though Donald Trump did actually post on Truth Social his congratulations, what a great result it was.
Yeah, but I think the Vance speech, the Vice President Vance in Munich, is still something that everybody here has in her or his bones. That was quite a shocker. And also on X, Elon Musk was quite vocal in his support for the AfD. So we don't know where we are.
We don't know where we are. Is that how it feels in Germany now with international relations?
More broadly, yes. Not only with the United States. I mean, with Russia, I think we have a clear impression that we are currently already under attack, not in a conventional war, but in a hybrid war. Our services warn about this. When it comes to China, our relationship is changing. So I think in just a couple of years, the fundamental kind of pillars of Germany's foreign policy orientation have been crumbling.
Well, the obvious question then is, Friedrich Merz the man for the hour?
I think so. I mean, I hope so. He's our best bet. I think he has enough of an understanding of what is going on. His foreign policy speeches and everything he has said, interviews, indicate that he understands how much is shifting. I mean, he is not very experienced as a
statesman.
Well,
that was my thought, really. Yes. He's not done so much, has he?
No, but he has been a businessman. He understands international relations. He has an understanding, I think, of the transatlantic relationship. He has been the head of the Atlantic Brücke. But of course, I mean, I'm also, here's to hope, you know, we don't have any other choice.
What about within Europe? He said he's already spoken to Emmanuel Macron
Yeah.
As he's heading to, well, he's in Washington now to speak to Donald Trump. What about that Franco-German relationship? How is that going to change, do you think?
So you have to understand that Merz was formed by his years in the European Parliament and by Wolfgang Schäuble, who has been his role model.
The former finance minister.
The former finance minister who is a staunch, or who was a staunch supporter of the Franco-German relationship. So France is the first thing that comes to Friedrich Merz's mind, and he has emphasized this on mutual occasions. But I'm very hopeful because he also mentions Poland quite a lot, the UK quite a lot, and I think this will be his way forward to find like-minded countries in Europe and form coalitions.
Yana Pouliarine, Senior Policy Fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Well, let's turn to the other major story out of this election. The far right, AfD, becoming the main opposition. It more than doubled its vote from the last election. It's made inroads away from its traditional eastern heartlands and attracted more young people with its anti-establishment message. Joining me, Hans-Jakob Schindler, Senior Director of the Counter-Extremism Project. It's an international non-profit organization based in New York and here in Berlin. It works to combat the threat from extremist ideologies. Welcome, Hans-Jakob. What, in your opinion, has led to this, what appears to be a marked move to the right?
Look, we have a very complex security situation. We have now, with the terror attack just a day before the elections, meters from where we're recording right now, the seventh terror attack in 10 months that really turned this election, which usually in Germany is run either on the economy or on social benefits issues, potentially also on the environment, completely around. And it really was dominated by the migration debate as well as internal security. And that, of course, then shifts the entire political spectrum, not only on these issues, but also on the political orientation.
What about social media? It's said that the AfD, and actually the parties on the populist left who did rather well, have been far more adept at using it and reaching younger voters.
That is true, but also social media does allow far more terrorist and extremist content on their platforms, as they did in the past. There are official announcements of several of the major platforms that they're not going to just reduce, but all but eliminate content moderation, which is, of course, exactly in the opposite direction of what it should be. We have a very highly incentivized, re-radicalized Islamist scene here in Germany, but also in Europe, feeding off the ongoing conflict in Ukraine, the Middle East. But we also have, as a counter-reaction, a highly incentivized right-wing extremist scene, including violence-oriented. And that creates a very complex security atmosphere.
And what sort of political atmosphere then does it create? Is this a particular moment, or do you think there is a springboard here for the AfD to do even better now that it is the second biggest party in Parliament?
I mean, we do need a turnaround in the domestic security situation. Seven attacks in 10 months. I've been working on counterterrorism issues for 25 years. I have not seen a series of terror attacks like this in my country ever. This is an unsustainable security situation, and therefore there needs to be a turnaround through this government. They don't have much time because the insecurity, or the feeling of insecurity, is palpable here in Germany. Every couple of weeks there's another story coming out. We just had an arrest of an 18-year-old who wanted to bomb the Israeli embassy here in Berlin. So there needs to be a clear turnaround. And otherwise, the elections and result are going to look
so,
very different.
So what's that going to look like, a turnaround? I mean, just tightening the borders? I mean, how far?
There really needs to be three steps. I mean, number one, of course, migration is the unavoidable political topic here. There needs to be a better and more effective management of the control of the borders, but also of the way that we extradite people, which is all but dysfunctional, because Germany decided over the last 20 years to organize this in the maximum complex way administratively. But the other real correlant to that one is that we do have to have a look at the way we treat data protection in this country and the legal basis for the internal and external security services of Germany to actually monitor the internet. And the third one is social media needs to be legally required to proactively cooperate with security forces.
Very briefly, though, the mere fact that the AfD is not invited to coalition talks, does that have an impact?
Not necessarily. I mean, this was clear from the very beginning, and this has been made clear by all parties of the democratic middle. So everyone who voted for the AfD was clear that this is not going to lead to any participation in government.
So it doesn't feed a sense that the people are voting and their vote's not being taken into account.
Look, I mean, governments are made on majorities, and there's always going to be parties who are not going to be in government. So that in a democracy, that is not exactly an unusual situation.
Hans-Jakob, many thanks. Hans-Jakob Schindler there from the Counter-Extremism Project. You're listening to NewsHour from London and Berlin.
In France, a doctor has gone on trial accused of sexually abusing nearly 300 patients, most of them children, between 1989 and 2014. Joël Le Squirnec, who's 74, has admitted most of the charges against him. He worked as a surgeon in dozens of hospitals and kept a journal detailing his abuse. The average age of the victims was 11. Many were under anaesthetic at the time. The BBC's Hugh Schofield in Paris is following the case.
It is the biggest ever court case of this nature on paedophile matters. The sheer number of victims is staggering, you know, 299, and they say there are more because there are people who were allegedly abused before a kind of statute of limitations came into effect, so, you know, that list could be longer. And I think most interesting about the case, in a way, is that the evidence is all kind of from him. I mean, nobody, or as far as I can see, very few of these victims actually remember anything, and many of them had no idea they had been abused. But the central piece of evidence in the case is these diaries, these journals, which Joël Le Squirnec, this doctor, kept privately at his home. And when they were found a few years ago, because he'd been caught in another case of paedophilia, when they were found, they revealed these long and quite awful diary entries in a kind of sex journal going back 25-30 years. And there, the police found the names of all the people that he abused in hospital, many of them under anaesthetic, because he was a kind of gastroenteric surgeon, you know, when people had appendix problems and so on, he was intervening. And he'd written down his fantasies and what he'd done with these boys and girls. And that then led the police to searching these people out. And for many of them, it was an absolute shock to be told that they'd been abused.
It also sort of raises questions about how he was able to abuse children in this way.
I think one needs to be clear about what actually we're talking about here. I mean, no one's trying to minimise or belittle what he did, but, you know, we're not talking about rapes in the conventional sense. We're talking about touching, we're talking about caressing, we're talking about fingers going when they shouldn't go. And obviously that is a different matter and much more easy to conceal than, you know, what people would conventionally imagine if we said, as we do, that he's been accused of rape. I think that's one reason why he was not detected. Another reason, of course, which is very much at the heart of this, is the usual thing when doctors are found accused of this kind of thing is the kind of blind trust which tends to be put in people, males of authority, in situations like this.
So I guess that's the other question, and I wonder how far it will be explored in this trial, is not whether there was sort of necessarily outright complicity, but whether concerns about this man had been raised and perhaps they hadn't been investigated thoroughly enough.
Well, we know that's certainly the case, and that's certainly part of this trial. We certainly know one thing, which is that he was found in 2004 to have downloaded, in fact, it was the CIA who alerted the French, to have downloaded paedophile child sex imagery. He was then prosecuted, he was found guilty, he was given a suspended prison sentence, but somehow that never, ever affected his subsequent career. And that is, I think, what people find shocking in this case. He went on, got new jobs, you know, he was able to continue.
And that was the BBC's Hugh Schofield in Paris. The death has been announced of one of the most distinctive singers, Roberta Flack. She was 88 years old and had been ill with ALS, a neurological condition, which obliged her to stop singing. Electra Naismith looks back at her life.
The first ever I saw your face.
The first time ever I saw your face was the first time most people had heard of Roberta Flack. Her version of the folk ballad featured on her debut album in 1969, but its popularity came later when it was chosen by the actor Clint Eastwood for a scene in his first film as director.
I was living in Alexandria, Virginia, and with my mom. She said, Roberta? I said, yes. She said, somebody named Clint Eastwood is on the phone. And I thought she was either putting me on or was somebody playing a joke on me. It was the real guy.
The first time ever I kissed you.
The song became Billboard's best-selling hit of 1972. It gave Flack her first number one and her first Grammy.
Strumming my pain with his fingers, singing my life with his words, killing me softly with his song, killing me softly with his song. Telling my
She won again a year later with Killing Me Softly, the first time an artist had won two Grammy Awards in a row for Record of the Year.
With his song.
The daughter of a church organist, she'd excelled at classical piano, gaining a music scholarship to Howard University aged just 15. It was that classical precision that led some to dismiss her music as boring, but that versatility was her great talent.
The whole while I was studying classical music, especially in my younger years, I was also doing a lot of do-ron-ron, shoo-doo-bee-doo, all of that stuff with my peers. So I've been fortunate to be surrounded by music all of my life, the Bach and the Chopin and the Schumann on one hand, and all of the rhythm and blues.
Roberta Flack did do real soul, but mainstream audiences wanted the smooth ballads, the gentle duets. That's what sold again and again. In 2022, she retired from singing, a diagnosis of the neurological disorder ALS making it impossible. It was a cruel end to a career that had spanned five decades, but her power as a performer, that goes on.
Ledra Naismith, looking back at Roberta Flack's life. Roberta Flack, who only really found fame in her 30s after she had given up being a junior high school teacher. She was a remarkable voice. We'll end this edition of NewsHour with one of her most distinctive tracks, compared to what one of her early efforts with the genius jazz bassist Ron Carter. From all of us on NewsHour, thanks for listening.